research. The research does show us that it takes on average 6 cycles for a woman's cycle to resume normally after coming off the pill, so for ovulation to resume normally. So this is 6 cycles. This is not 6 months, 6 cycles. It would take 18 months for someone's cycle to get back ovulating. This is not just people that have PCOS, but this could be someone who's just been on the pill for, you know, 15 years of their life, which is also really common for me to see.
Hi, I'm Claire Goodwin, and this is the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. I have PCOS too, and I know how hard it can be to get the help you need. So I bring together my expertise as a registered nutritionist and exercise scientist, together with other experts I trust and people with real-life lived experience of PCOS, to help you get the information you need to make a real difference to your symptoms. Now, if you've been struggling with PCOS, working with us might just be the game changer you've been looking for. You see, PCOS is a complex hormonal disorder that can affect everything from your menstrual cycle to your fertility to your mental health. And while medication can be helpful in managing some of the symptoms of PCOS, it's often not enough on its own. That's where a lifestyle change comes in. We take a holistic approach to PCOS, looking at everything from your diet to your stress levels to your sleep habits, and create a personalized plan that works for you. We'll help you make lifestyle changes that can reduce your symptoms, improve your fertility, and boost your overall well-being. Whether you're struggling with weight gain, acne, or mood swings, we'll work with you to develop a plan that's tailored to your unique needs and goals. And the best part? We'll be with you every step of the way, providing support, accountability, and guidance as you navigate your PCOS journey. We have both our fully supported 12-week program, the PCOS Protocol, or you can book one-on-one appointments with myself, Claire, or one of our other qualified nutritionists. Head to thepcosnutritionist.com to either sign up for the PCOS Protocol or to book a one-on-one appointment. The links are in the show notes. In today's episode, we're going to be talking all about post-pill PCOS, i.e., if you never had any PCOS symptoms before going on hormonal birth control, and now after coming off it, you've suddenly got all these symptoms, that's what we'd refer to as maybe post-pill PCOS. It's a frequently asked for topic on this podcast, probably because there's so little known about it. So we'll be diving into, what is it? Is it even a thing? Is there any research on it? What I see clinically, and what the treatment options are. Okay, so today we are talking all about post-pill PCOS, and we turn the tables a little bit. Charlie is going to interview me about post-pill PCOS and basically, do I think it's a thing? What could be going on here? What could be other explanations? What the research tells us? And then what are the potential treatments for this as well?
Amazing. Thank you, Claire. I'm very excited to dive a bit deeper into post-pill PCOS with you today and a couple of things that might be happening and sort of giving the listeners some tips and things to look out for and other things like that. So why don't we start off by, I would love to know a little bit about, in your clinical experience, whether you think PCOS is a thing or not, or sort of how common it is that you see it.
Yeah, so I think that post-pill PCOS is a thing. I think that we definitely see it clinically. What I would say is that this is the typical thing that I would see. I would see generally it's picked up when someone is trying to get pregnant. So I generally see it in fertility patients. And what I generally see is it's when someone's had normal cycles, so they have maybe only gone on hormonal birth control. And when I'm talking about post-pill, what I mean is any hormonal birth control. So it could be the Implanon, could be the Mirena IUD, anything that's got hormones in it. And when someone's been on hormonal birth control, but generally it's that their periods have regulated before going on there. So it might be that when they're in their like late teens or early 20s or mid 20s, periods were totally fine before that, and now coming off hormonal birth control, their periods are like non-existent. Maybe they've had a period so they came off the pill within about 30 days, they got one period, but then now it's been like 4 months and they've not seen any period, or maybe it's even, and then they do see one, but then the next one doesn't come for another 90 days. This would be a really classic picture. Or they just get no period at all, or another kind of pattern of it being really irregular. Whatever it is, it's certainly not every, I wouldn't even say every 35 or 40 or 45 days. It's a lot more irregular than that. And yeah, and but I think the key thing here is that I would call it like, or I think that it would be post-pill PCOS if they had definitely had regular cycles before going on that. And a lot of people, we don't know this because they've been put on the pill when they were like 15 or 16. And before then, it's really normal for teenagers to have irregular cycles. So we wouldn't then know if that was a normal thing or not. So if it's been regular, then they're putting on the pill and then they've come off and it's now really irregular, then that's the kind of really common pattern that I see.
Yeah, definitely very hard if you didn't know what your cycle was doing beforehand, or like you said, when you were 14, 15 years old, it's really common to see a bit more irregularities in your cycle. So yeah, I guess just harder to see coming off what is normal for you, right? Before your sort of cycle has figured out its own rhythm, what normal looks like for you with your pattern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people then, you know, if you then go to your doctor and say, well, this is what's going on, they might run some tests. Now, PCOS is what's called a diagnosis of exclusion. So they really should run, like, look at any other factor for why you might not be getting a cycle, like your thyroid and maybe something called hypothalamic amenorrhea, which is when your brain, your hypothalamus in your brain, and amenorrhea is not getting a period, when your brain is telling your body don't ovulate because it's not safe. So those are the really common things. There can be other things as well. So your doctor should be really looking at all of those things. But what they might find is that they can't see anything else there, or maybe they don't know what to look for, and therefore you're exhibiting signs of irregular cycles. And generally also, if you've got irregular cycles, you may also have follicles on your ovaries or cysts. And those are two things that could then mean that you get diagnosed with PCOS, even though it's not really true PCOS. And what I mean by that is that 25% of all women have those follicles or cysts on the ovaries. So you walk down the street at the moment, we're just looking down like the main street here in Takapuna, and if I picked out 100 women on the street and scanned and got them to be scanned, their ovaries to be scanned, 25 of them would have follicles on their ovaries. But that doesn't mean that 25% have PCOS. It just means that 25 have follicles on their ovaries. Only probably 10% of them will have PCOS. So you could have that irregular cycle and also have follicles on your ovaries and therefore technically fit the diagnostic criteria of PCOS. But it's, you know, like, it may not really be PCOS. So I think that's the other like quite hard thing to know. I say that PCOS can be quite a hard condition to diagnose. So that could also be going on.
Yeah, definitely. So how common would you say that is with patients that you see or people that you talk to over social media and things?
Post-pill PCOS?
Yeah.
Really, like not very common. So I would say that I probably see it in 2% of the PCOS patients versus I would say that I probably, given the amount of questions I get about it, I think that more like 10 or maybe 20% think that they have post-pill PCOS. So what I mean by that is that when, you know, they're trying to understand what might be driving their PCOS and therefore what they can do about it, and they don't think that they fit the pattern of having insulin resistance, or they don't fit the pattern of having high stress hormones. They may have had a TSH test done on their thyroid and that looks normal, or their doctor said that their thyroid is normal, and so therefore they are like, well, it must then be post-pill PCOS because I came off the pill and I've got it. And I generally find that that's not the case. Generally what's happened there is that the right questions haven't been asked, and if it is, we can generally find what else might be really driving that. So that's the discrepancy between why I think that it's, definitely think it's going on, but I don't think it's as common as what people think it is.
Yeah, it is a hard one because there can be quite a lot of different things at play. And like you said, if someone doesn't maybe resonate with having high stress hormones, they may not think that's a driver for their PCOS and they're looking for other answers, and it totally makes sense to look for an answer and look for what the cause is for you, because then it might help you with your best treatment plan or sort of what your next steps are and sort of a bit more of an answer and piecing together the puzzle of how you came about your diagnosis.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people, even if it is sort of true post-pill PCOS, whereby someone has had, I can see that they've had really like no symptoms before going on hormone birth control, and suddenly now they have definitely got some of those symptoms. It might be that they have those really regular cycles, they may even have a bit of acne, they may even have a little bit of weight gain around the middle, and whereas they never exhibited any of that before. It doesn't mean that it's not post-pill PCOS, but it also doesn't mean that there's nothing else there, like there's not some like insulin resistance that's developed. And I think that's when you understand the mechanisms of how potentially the hormonal birth control could be contributing to sort of post-pill PCOS, that will make a lot more sense to you as to why you can sort of have both. And I think the good thing about that too is that then there's something you can do about it. Whereas if it's just like, you know, the pill and there's, you know, you can't go back in time and not go on that, then, you know, you'd think there's nothing I can do about it. Whereas actually there is, most of the time there is heaps that we can do lifestyle-wise to improve that. So, yeah, so I think maybe we talk about how this is.
Yeah, definitely. I would love to know a bit more from you about what you think the potential mechanism. So what is driving this post-pill PCOS that we're seeing?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing to say is that there is no research on this. And we can talk a bit about that in a minute. Oh, no, actually, let's talk about that now. So I think there isn't any research into this. And I think that a lot of this is due to the fact that there tends not to be a lot of questions asked about the pill, a lot of critical questions asked about hormonal birth control. In medicine, hormonal birth control is seen as a bit of a fix-all, and therefore, you know, if we then query that and go, hold on, is this actually, yes, it might be giving people a regular bleed and it might be helping with other PCOS symptoms, but is this the good thing long term, then we open up a can of worms for ourselves by doing that, and potentially our fix-all treatment is not as good as we once thought it would. So I think that there are generally not enough. I mean, I just to give you some clarity on this, I think that the pill is amazing for many things. I think the pill is amazing for contraception and potentially for improving some PCOS symptoms, but I certainly don't think it's amazing for everybody and in all situations like it's handed out at the moment. So I think that we need to be a lot more scrupulous in working out who it's right for and giving the right, giving women enough information to actually make an informed consent to doing that, as opposed to just going, yes, so for example, yes, it will give you a regular bleed, but it won't make you ovulate, which is the reason why you're not getting a period at the moment. So just to be aware of that while it's going to give you a bleed, don't think that for a minute that it's actually fixing the problem. And when you come off the pill, your period's going to be as irregular as what they are now, if not more irregular. I think that would be the kind of informed consent that women actually need. So yeah, that's my view on it. But I think in medicine, and there's not enough critical thought that goes into that. And so therefore, you know, that then determines the kind of research questions that we ask. And that's a lot of the reason why maybe there hasn't been any research into the potential kind of post-pill effects of PCOS as well. I mean, yeah, post-pill PCOS, effects of the pill.
Yeah, totally. And I think that was an important note that you made. For some people, the pill and hormonal birth control is amazing and it works wonders. And like you said, for the sole purpose of contraception, it does a great job because it does suppress ovulation. So we know from that perspective, it's great. It's just we haven't been asking these critical questions or looking into actually what else is going on. Are there other things we need to look at? Does this impact mood? Are there other things at play with taking the pill? And how does it work for this individual?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that a really good example of this is that women have been complaining about weight gain and the pill for decades. The pill was invented it was about the 60s. I actually don't know the actual date, but say it's definitely since the 1960s. Women have been complaining about the weight gain being caused by the pill for, now it's 2023 now, so let's call that 60 years.
It's a long time.
It's a long time, right? And it's always been brushed aside and said, no, this is not the case. Finally, in 2023, we finally had a study confirming that, yes, the progestin in the pill, the synthetic progesterone part, can cause weight gain in some people. And that's my example of where there hasn't been enough critical thinking. And this is also, I mean, there's a huge, like, discussion around this, just in terms of like women's voices being, or women being told that they're crazy and just not being listened to and things like that. That has, you know, that's historically been the case and still is the case today. So that plays a big role in that. But yeah, generally just not enough critical thinking and therefore research going into this. And I don't know why, you know, how much big pharma plays into this. I suspect quite a lot, given that this, could be quite a big money driver. I don't actually know now how much like money hormonal contraceptive makes for them, but I presume quite a lot. So there's a huge amount of different factors for why we might not see any research behind this. But generally, I think it is just lack of critical thinking.
Mm. And also there is a bit of a lack of research in the female population in general, which does make it really tricky because we don't have that insight. And I think that was historically something that research was typically done on males. So it's, I feel like we are getting a little bit better now, but as you said, we've had hormonal birth control since the 60s and we don't have a lot of data and research on actually what's been happening over the last 60 years or these trends and things that we've been seeing because it just hasn't been done.
Yeah, absolutely. You're so right. I think that it's getting better now. I recently heard, I think it was in a Huberman podcast, that a lot of the research now in the ethics has to show a balance of female male kind of, because historically as a researcher, it's so much easier to research males because you don't have to consider the effect of things like hormonal birth control and or their natural like ovulation and follicular phase versus luteal phase or menopause versus non-menopause versus perimenopause and the effect that, that could then have on the outcome. And when you're a researcher and you're trying to do a randomized control trial and you're trying to remove out as many variables as possible, because a randomized control trial is where you want to just change one variable. And so when you're doing that, you really, it's much harder to do that when you have so many variables in the woman's cycle. So I remember talking to Professor Grant Schofield about this in our podcast, and he said, yeah, that's the way it's kind of been done in their a lot of their research. Not because that's right, but just because of the way as well that our research institutions are rewarded, right? As that, you know, if you produce more great research, then the better that the university is going to be ranked, and the better you, the higher you as a researcher are going to move up the ranks as well, and the, you know, the more kind of credibility you're going to get. So you're driven to want to get that, those outcomes, and therefore removing any variables like female cycles is a great thing to do.
Exactly. It's much, much easier to control for. And while I think we're all equal, I was talking to a friend the other day and we were reflecting on the amazing thing that our cycle and reproductive system is as being a female, and she called us the superior race, which I thought was just awesome. Like the amazing stuff that our body can do, which yeah, I guess a male just won't know because they don't have those same fluctuations. But yeah, equality, but I just thought that was a great point to
yeah,
make.
It is. And so yeah, I think you're right that I think the combination of not enough critical questioning the pill and just in general, not enough research being done on females equates to not enough research about, you know, the post-pill effects of people coming off the pill and how their hormones, like even hormones like their insulin that controls their blood sugar or their sex hormones, can change when it's been exposed to the hormones and hormonal birth control for, you know, potentially a long period of time, many years, and, you know, what that has effect has long term on the body. And maybe that is because a lot of time we don't want to know. You know, if it's been handed out, if it's been prescribed as a fix-all for a lot of women's conditions, then if we, you know, suddenly find out it's not that great, then that means that we potentially have to change that recommendation, and that can be difficult. So there's that old age-old saying, don't fix something if it's not broken. And I would say that that is being applied to the pill, but yet it's more the fact that we're just not looking at the fact that it's broken. We're not actually looking carefully and saying, it looks good from, it looks okay from the outside. You know, it's pretty good for most people, so let's just not look too closely. But if we look closely, we might see that for actually a lot of people, it's not really working for them.
Yeah, and I think if we flip and look from a GP or a doctor's perspective for a second, it is really hard because they have a 15-minute appointment. They're usually running late. They've got a lot of things on their mind. Someone might come in and the pill might seem like the answer. And then from the patient, it's tricky because it seems like you're not really being listened to properly, or if you get put on one form of hormonal birth control that doesn't work for you, there quite often can be quite a lot of trial and error, which is frustrating as well. So yeah, maybe it's not quite yet broken, but there's definitely some cracks.
Yeah, definitely. So then that's kind of, I guess, the caveat that there is not a lot of research here. So everything else we're talking about really is either theory or clinical experience. So you asked before about, well, what would be the potential mechanisms? And there are a few theories that I've got here. One is that the research does show that hormonal contraceptive can increase testosterone. And so one thing to know is that in hormonal contraceptive, there's a thing called a progestin, which is a synthetic progesterone. Now, your body produces progesterone when you have ovulated. So your egg is surrounded by a thing called a corpus luteum. That is like a sac, and that makes progesterone. And that is what keeps your uterine lining in place when you're not pregnant. So what comes out when you get a period is actually the lining of your endometrium. It's not blood, it's actually blood and tissue and the whole like lining of that. And so when you're taking when you've ovulated, your body produces progesterone, and that's what keeps the lining in place. And then unless you're pregnant, and whereby the lining stays intact. If you're not pregnant, then your body will go, oh, we're not pregnant, so let's shed that lining and build a new nest, new lining, for in case we get pregnant next cycle. So the same thing happens when you're taking, say, the combined pill. You're taking the pill, and while you're taking that pill, it keeps the lining intact. But as soon as you stop taking it or take the sugar pills, the lining like sheds, and therefore you then get a period. So, but that the progestin in the different forms of hormonal birth control change. So some of the older, so different pharmaceutical companies create different progestins and older progestins versus like the newer ones, so ones that were created in like the 60s versus the ones that were created in the 2000s. And they all have different properties. And one of the properties is whether they increase testosterone or androgens or lower it. And so if you're on one that's increased testosterone, then maybe when you come off the pill, your body is still exhibiting higher testosterone. And therefore you get some of the symptoms of that, like you might get acne or some weight gain, or you might get irregular periods, which is generally the common one. And because it messes with your other hormones that control your cycle. So that is one of my theories.
Amazing. Thank you so much for breaking that down. I think it's really empowering for us to ask these critical questions and to look more into actually what components are in the pill that we're taking, whether that's a progestin that's a pro-androgen, an anti-androgen, or sometimes there can be neutral, like no effect as well. So a lot of people don't know this, and I would love to actually know how much doctors actually know about this as well, and whether they've looked too much into it before they prescribe it to you. Very interesting to look into. So
that's a really good point. It is something that if you are still on hormonal birth control, to which probably if you're listening to this episode is probably unlikely, but if you are on one, just like find out if it is actually increasing your testosterone, because it could be making symptoms a lot worse than better. And because if you're on the right progestin, it can lower testosterone. If you're going to be on the pill, you might as well be on the right pill for it to actually improve PCOS symptoms. There's no point in being on the wrong one. So, I mean, for most people, that they respond much better to the right one for PCOS. So that's a good point. The other thing, so that was the like what one theory of how the pill could then cause like this post-pill PCOS. The other is that we do know from the research that the pill can cause a little bit of insulin resistance. And insulin is your hormone that controls your blood sugar. So if you think about it like a little mop that goes up, and when you eat something like an apple, your body releases insulin to go and mop up the sugar in the apple and go and store that away for later. Now, your body should only need, say, 5 units of insulin to do that job when you eat an apple. But if you've developed some insulin resistance, it now might need 7 units or 10 units or 20 units of insulin to do the same job. So it's become less sensitive to the insulin and therefore needs more to do the same job. But the problem is that your body, those of us that are sensitive to this, when our bodies are exposed to more insulin, that actually creates a like chain reaction of events in the body. And one of those is that it can increase testosterone and androgens and therefore lead to our hormones that control our menstrual cycle to be all disrupted. It can cause weight gain. It can cause our blood sugar to go up and down like a roller coaster. So we get really hungry or maybe getting sugar cravings. And also the increased testosterone can lead to things like acne and facial and body hair growth or hair loss or other symptoms as well. So that could be, that's my other theory about how it could kind of cause this post-pill PCOS. And I think that's a strong theory because even people, even patients that I've seen that have had absolutely no issues with their periods before going on hormonal birth control, and they might have gone on in their like mid-20s, and then come off 5 years later and now have these irregular cycles, a bit of acne, maybe a little bit of weight gain. When I look at their symptoms and test their blood, I can see there's a little bit of insulin resistance. So that's like a strong theory behind this. And then the last thing that I think could be going on is that your hormonal birth control also increases the number of sponges in your body that go around and mop up all of your excess testosterone. This is called sex hormone binding globulin. So it binds those sex hormones. And so when the pill increases those, then your body's natural production of those may lower. And so then when you come off the pill, think about it that you've then just gone and taken away all those sponges. So a way that I like to think about it is like, imagine if your toddler or like a toddler has gone into your bathroom, put the plug into the basin, turned the taps on and left them going. Inside your body, that's the taps of testosterone are being turned on. Now you've got this plug in and it's overflowing. Is that what we're doing with a pill is we're just going and throwing sponges into that basin to mop up the water. We're not turning the taps of testosterone off generally. We're throwing the sponges in there to mop that up. So imagine by taking away when you come off the pill, you've just gone into the bathroom and taken away all those sponges and towels that are mopping up that water to stop your basin from overflowing, is that the taps are still going to be on full bore. And they might even have been turned up because one of the things the pill can cause is increased testosterone. So you might have even turned them higher. You've just taken away all those sponges. And so now, therefore, the basin is definitely going to overflow with, and inside your body, that looks like overflowing kind of testosterone, and your body's being exposed to a lot more of this. So that is another theory, and one that I like definitely can't substantiate yet, but it's just a mechanism that is happening with the pill and may be contributing to you having these symptoms now coming off the pill.
Yeah, what a great analogy. I love that visual and it totally makes a lot of sense. And like you said, it's tricky because the high testosterone and the insulin piece is such a vicious cycle and they feed into each other. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to know, sort of where to intervene or which one came first or if it's sort of both things happening. But one thing you did mention was looking at blood work to see if insulin resistance was potentially something for one of your clients. So what sort of blood tests are you talking about that you might look into?
Yeah, so that's generally one that if I can't ascertain from symptoms, and I always ask them about really specific symptoms about that I know are really connected with how their insulin is functioning, I can generally find that out. And if I really can't tell if they're not exhibiting a lot of those symptoms, then I'll generally do ask them if they can do quite a extensive insulin test. This is not just a fasting glucose or an HbA1c or an A1c that your doctor might run, because those tests are really, they're not very sensitive at picking up early changes in insulin. Even the A1c, I think they found the stat was, and I put it in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS. You can look up any of these research studies in there. But they, I think they found that it was 70% of even type 2 diabetes patient wouldn't show up high on an A1c. So that to me is just showing that that's super insensitive. And type 2 diabetes is the, like, is the long-term or manifestation of insulin resistance when we can't resolve that or don't resolve that early enough. So this is like after insulin has gotten much worse. And we see changes in women's bodies in terms of the amount of testosterone they're producing and therefore the effect on their cycles, the effect on their like ovulation. We see that with just slight changes in insulin. So just waiting for an HbA1c to be high is not good enough. It's like we're catching it way too late. And so if you've just had that done with your doctor, chances are that's going to look normal, but it doesn't mean that your insulin is actually functioning normally.
Yeah, wow, 70%, that is a very high statistic. And I think it just goes to show that while HbA1c can be great at a population level and for some people perhaps, it's actually an average measure of the last 3 months. So it doesn't tell us, like you said, that what's happening sort of by every meal, or it doesn't give us that information of what's happening at a much lower level of actually how is your insulin and your blood sugar reacting on a day-to-day basis rather than just generally, because there could be a couple of times throughout the day or even in your cycle where it's much worse, where the three-month average just can't give us that kind of data.
No, definitely not. And it's not sensitive enough to pick up the change. You know, it might say, for example, it might pick up when your insulin is now, I gave you that example of the apple before and 5 units of insulin. That's not a true figure, by the way, but it's just an example. And your HbA1c might not change until your insulin is 300, but yet your ovulation and your periods might be disrupted when your insulin's at 20. So that's the kind of like granularity we actually need to see, therefore, what changes we can make and how we can actually get your body working optimally, make a difference to your symptoms.
Yeah, definitely. And I like how you began by saying we focus on symptom first, and I think it sort of comes back to you are the expert of your own body, and actually how you feel can really help practitioners such as yourself know how people's bodies are responding and what could be at play. And that's sort of one of the most important things. Yes, blood tests are so helpful and they can help us piece together the puzzle of what's happening for you or get some further insight, but actually how you're feeling really does tell us quite a lot more, and we can get a lot of insight, and there's a lot of power in sort of the symptoms that you're displaying.
Yeah, definitely. And also it can tell us where to look first. Because sometimes like running tests can be expensive, and so we need to focus your finances and resources on the area that we think are most likely going to be the case. And if I can tell from other symptoms that your blood sugar is definitely not normal, then why would we waste money getting, because some in many countries the test that we actually need for insulin is, can be really expensive, and so why would we waste your money on that when actually we would be much better to spend it on things that we can't tell from your symptom, like your, you know, is your iron too high or too low? Is your thyroid working properly? And all those other things where you might also have symptoms, but we can't tell as easily from symptoms.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point to make. So would you say that most of the people that you see with post-pill PCOS do have this insulin resistance at play?
Yeah, good question. I would say yes. And the good thing about that is it's something that we can correct quite easily. And generally, people with post-pill PCOS only have a little bit of insulin resistance that's been developed since being on the pill, and therefore they respond really well to like lifestyle change. So changing when I get them to change what they're eating, how they're moving, their vitamins and minerals, they tend to respond really well. So that's actually can be quite good news. If they don't, then the other thing I think is that they may have something called hypothalamic amenorrhea as well. And this is where your brain is hypothalamus in your brain. Amenorrhea is not getting a period, so it's your brain telling your body don't ovulate because it's not safe. And generally the reasons for, so this is a survival mechanism that we've developed thousands of years ago when food was not plentiful and we couldn't just go and get more food. Like if animal wasn't available or we couldn't capture it or there wasn't anything else that we could forage, we literally would go without food. And in periods of famine, we didn't want to be bringing a baby into the world if we could not even survive ourselves. So our body, I think, is incredible at how it can do this. You know, you think how actually, you don't even have to think about this. It's not something conscious you have to do. It's kind of like breathing or your heart beating, that your body can, your brain can take in that information and make that decision and say, we're not ovulating. This is not safe. Like, how incredible is that? Like, that is our natural contraceptive, which is pretty phenomenal. But the problem is that because our lives are so different now, our brain can't. The other thing we talked about, I didn't talk about, was the stress aspect of that. So if you're under a lot of stress in terms of that, your life is physically at threat. Again, we don't want to be bringing a baby into the world there. But unfortunately, our brain hasn't yet developed to recognize psychological stress as opposed to a physical threat to our life. And I think that's the unfortunate thing where it's working against us at the moment, is that we're not necessarily in danger of our life, but we are under a certain amount of stress. And so therefore our body has still turned our ovulation off because it thinks it's doing the right thing, but actually it's hindering us.
Yeah, it's this amazing process, but we haven't yet figured out how to differentiate these different stresses, and that maybe it might be a safe environment to bring a baby into the world and to be able to ovulate and do all these things with different stresses. Maybe if it's something that's an emotional stress versus a low energy availability stress, like you said before, in a state of famine or something like that, it's very different. But yeah, it's an amazing response for sure.
Yeah. So that would be the other thing I often see, is that hypothalamic amenorrhea is obviously where you're not getting a period at all. And so if you can have this alongside PCOS, or you can just have this, but because you've got very similar symptoms, you may have been misdiagnosed with PCOS. So this is that's probably the other thing I see very, very commonly in this kind of someone that's being diagnosed with PCOS, and it's their periods and stuff used to be totally fine before going on it, is that maybe they have developed some hypothalamic amenorrhea while they've been on the pill, and that might be causing that.
Yeah. And so how would someone differentiate if they wanted to bring this up with their doctor between post-pill PCOS and something like hypothalamic amenorrhea?
Yeah, so both are quite hard to diagnose. I was saying before at the start that PCOS really is a diagnosis of exclusion, and so there's no like just one blood test. It sort of is your doctor or your endocrinologist's kind of best guess. And so the one test that they might look at, they can look at, is your luteinizing hormone and your follicle stimulating hormone. Those are two hormones that are crucial in you ovulating. And in many people with PCOS, you'll see the luteinizing hormone is too high and or higher than what it would normally optimally be. But in hypothalamic amenorrhea, it can be low, and actually the FSH can be high. It sort of can be the opposite picture. But that is not, certainly not the case for everybody. And so therefore it can be a helpful test, but it doesn't necessarily rule it in or rule it out. I would probably be asking a lot more questions about their history and about, so not just their like stress now or their like what, you know, their energy availability now. I would also ask that of their past as well. So when we're talking about food, I found that a lot of people, so when we're talking about when your brain can turn off your ovulation because there's not enough food, it doesn't mean that you've got a eating disorder or you're starving yourself. Both definitely can happen, but also they don't have to. You could just have what's called low energy availability. So think about that as you are eating 1,800 calories, but expecting your body to do the work of 3,000 calories. And therefore there is like a huge difference between those. And therefore your body determines that there's not enough energy available to do all of that work. So now it has to make some choices about what it does and doesn't do. So one of the easiest choices to make is to turn off ovulation, because that takes energy. And so it can, you know, and can remove those. So you might feel completely satiated, full, or, you know, you're not feeling like you're starving. But your brain, your body is going, yeah, but I can't do all of these things you're asking me to. I can't work out 5 days a week, and I can't also have the like energy available to my brain to do all of this mental work that you're asking me to do, and also, you know, do all the like main things in my body that I need to do, like breathe and make red blood cells and make hair and everything that I need to do. So this is often, I have to have this conversation with patients where I say, right, we actually need to increase what you're eating to actually get your body back ovulating. And they say, but I'm not starving myself, I'm not hungry. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, you can feel completely full from, but it's not enough for your body to actually work properly. So in that instance, like, I've had patients that I've needed to increase what they're eating to like 2700 calories to actually get their ovulation back. And it can be a lot more than what they were previously eating, but yet they weren't dieting or starving or like consciously doing it.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that can take quite a lot of time and overcompensation for your body to really trust that this is safe and that you do have the resources available. And I think if we look back at that evolutionary response, this amazing process the body's come up with, it totally makes sense, because when we are under stress or under pressure and we need that fight or flight response to help give us that burst of energy to help us sustain and live through that, we have a stress hormone called cortisol, which is produced when this is prolonged to help us through that phase. And of course, when we have limited resources, our body will prioritize cortisol, because that's most important to get us through this stressor and through this phase, rather than prioritizing other functions such as producing reproductive hormones or putting energy into ovulation, like you said, because actually just surviving that evolutionary process is much more important right now, and that's what your body detects. So yeah, it's pretty clever that it can do that, but maybe right now it's frustrating that, yeah, you do have to really overcompensate and put in that time and remind your body that it doesn't need to be in this state of stress, or that there are the resources available.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is such a good segue into that it's not just about the lack of energy. You know, like, you might, there's often cases where there's, you know, food is plentiful and that's not an issue for this person, but it's the stress. And I think there's sometimes when I say to patients, I'm like, okay, we need to work on this. And they're like, but I'm not stressed. And I think this is also a really important thing to realize, is that your perception of stress might be really different to your brain's perception of stress. And you might be comparing yourself to someone else and saying, well, I'm not doing anything more, or don't have any more stress in my life than like Lucy, who I work with, and she's got no issue because she's pregnant. And but a patient said to me an analogy that her doctor had given her, and I think this is really good. Her doctor said, look, everyone's got a stress backpack that they walk around with, but they're not all the same size. So some people have like a 60-liter stress backpack, and some people have a 20-liter stress backpack. And so you can only fit as much stress into your backpack as what it is, what the capacity is there. You can't, you know, once it starts overflowing, that's when you get the symptoms. And so you might have a really different stress, you know, stress backpack, or your stress tolerance might be a lot less than someone else's. And things can, you know, can affect this. So there's a study that has been done that I also talked about in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS, which is that they have found that stress around puberty can really set your stress response for life. And high levels of stress during that puberty time can mean that you're less resilient or less tolerant to stress than someone that didn't have a lot of stress at that time. And stress could be anything. It could be training if you're an athlete. It could be a marriage breakdown in your family, or moving a lot, or anything that you kind of perceived as highly stressful. And that's the other thing, is that we all perceive different things as stressful. I mean, we see this all the time, that you can be doing something at work that you perceive really like easy and fun, whereas someone else could find that really stressful because that's not the way that their brain is wired. So don't think about stress as just being constant for everybody, or don't discredit that as being a source, when actually it could be that if someone else looked at that, they could, you know, see that you're exhibiting the signs and symptoms of your stress response not working properly. And one of the biggest sources of stress that I see is lack of sleep. And this is probably another big one where people say to me, yeah, but I'm getting a normal amount. I'm getting like 7, maybe 8 hours. And I'm like, who said that's normal? Do we know it's normal for you? Probably not. Like, you might actually need 8.5 or 9 hours for your body. So that can be another really, like, really big factor in hypothalamic amenorrhea as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think the sleep is a big one. I was talking with a client the other day who was on holiday, and she said, oh my gosh, I can't get over it. I'm sleeping so much more at the moment. I'm sleeping in until like 9 or 10 a.m. whereas when I get up for work, I have to be up at 6:30. I'm not sure what's happening. I'm just sleeping through my alarm. I'm missing everything. And we sort of like took a step back and realized that actually she was going to bed much later. And previous to that, in the work week, she was still going to bed pretty late. So not that you can play catch up, but I think her body was just so exhausted now that she had the opportunity to catch up on a little bit of sleep and get some extra without the disruption of having to get up for work. She had the time to do it. And we realized actually you need more than just 6 hours of sleep, even if the next person can be functioning totally fine on 6 hours. It looks like at the moment your natural wake cycle is giving you 8 hours. So how can we meet in the middle and bridge this gap a little bit and get you to bed a little bit earlier?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what most people find, is that actually they're trying to get away with far too little, and given the opportunity, their body would require a lot more. But it's just that we're not giving that opportunity because we're using things to wake us up, like alarms, that they're artificial, right? We wouldn't have had those thousands of years ago. We would have had the sunrise. But it is a really common one that I see. So yeah, those are kind of probably the two things that I see when it comes to the true post-pill PCOS and what else could be going on there. The last one is probably a thyroid condition that hasn't been diagnosed as well can be really common if it's and sometimes this can really just be, again, looking back at what's happened in the process of them being diagnosed with PCOS. So that's often where I'll start, is I'll be like, okay, so tell me how your doctor diagnosed you with PCOS. And if they don't know, I'll like find that out. And it might be that they just haven't done that process of exclusion as well as they might have needed to. And they may have missed a condition which could otherwise be causing their symptoms now too.
Yeah, totally. And I think we know that we look at an optimal lab range when we're looking at blood test results such as a thyroid panel, because we know that within this certain range, we want your thyroid to be functioning optimally, not just at base level. You know, we want it to be functioning as best as it can to best serve you and your health. And even when it's within the lab range, so what you might see that your doctor says is totally fine, we can see symptoms and we can see things interfering with your cycle. So that's definitely something to look into as well, is, well, actually, yes, maybe my thyroid is functioning within the lab range, but how is that optimally? Or am I doing everything that I can? Or what else can we look into here?
Yeah, definitely. So that would be the main things I look at. And then the last thing would be what I often see as well is just not, the patient just hasn't had enough time for their ovulation to come back normally after coming off the pill. And this is supported in the research. The research does show us that it takes on average 6 cycles for a woman's cycle to resume normally after coming off the pill. So for ovulation to resume normally. So this is 6 cycles. This is not 6 months, 6 cycles. So in the case I gave you before where they might have had a period 30 days after coming off the pill, but they're not another period for another 6 months, and then one 90 days later, that's only 3 cycles, right? And now we're already at 9-10 months. So I see very commonly that it would take 18 months for someone's cycle to get back ovulating. And this is not just people that have PCOS, but this could be someone who's just been on the pill for, you know, 15 years of their life, which is also really common for me to see. So, yeah, I would generally say that a lot of the true post-pill PCOS is just that they probably wouldn't be diagnosed with anything if they went back to their doctor 18 months or 2 years later and their period had kind of resumed normally. But that's not to say that you should just wait it out, right? Like, if you've come off the pill, especially if you're trying to conceive, the earlier that you can get some tests run and figure out if there's anything else going on, the better. And also, too, the quicker you can probably get treatment for that. So the treatment isn't just waiting it out. Like, there's a lot of other great medical treatments now that can help with that. So letrozole or Clomid would be the main drugs to help stimulate ovulation. Or micronized progesterone can be used for PCOS as well. We use this cyclically to help kind of teach your body how to ovulate again. So I would say that although I think that a lot of these cases wouldn't be diagnosed if they visited their doctor 18 months or 2 years later, it doesn't mean that you have to wait. You can still go and like get help, get tested, make sure that there's nothing else going on that needs to be treated, like a thyroid condition. Get that maybe if there is a little bit of insulin resistance, get the lifestyle changes sorted. And therefore, it might mean that you get resolution quicker, or alternatively, you get the medication you need to help you ovulate as well.
Yeah, exactly, because it can take a long time. And like you said, a lot of the post-pill PCOS clients that you see are fertility patients, right? So they're people that are trying to conceive and wanting to start a family, probably don't want to wait 18 months to see if it's going to work out. We need to look at what else we can do in the meantime, or ruling out certain conditions so that we can best support bringing back that ovulation in the best way that we know possible, whether that's naturally with lifestyle changes or else with medication, which is also a great option for some people if they need it.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.